This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Welcome to the Trumpet's weekly review of all the important news. I'm Joel Hilliker, and with me is our panel. Here in the studio, we have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be here.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And also there in our British office today, Brent Noctegal.
Hello.
Well, Gerald Fleury was right. If you've been following the Trumpet for any length of time, you know how he was sounding the alarm about the corruption within the Obama administration the entire time he was in office, and he began linking him with biblical prophecies of a destructive spirit undermining America. He published the booklet America Under Attack in 2013, and this booklet exposed just how deadly that administration really was. If you've read that booklet, you've understood this spiritual dimension for quite some time. But the full extent of the corruption within that administration is becoming clearer and clearer now with Donald Trump in power and William Barr running the Justice Department. This week, Attorney General Barr released a trove of documents that gives us an even clearer picture of what Mr. Fleury has been saying for years. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, we actually started off this week with a tweet from the president, President Donald Trump, announcing that Obamagate is the biggest political crime in American history. And then he waited a day later and followed that up with Obamagate makes Watergate look small time. And so these are some grand claims. Watergate was the only scandal that ever caused a president to actually resign. And he's saying that he's bigger than even that. And that can be something that's pretty easy if you're not following the ins and outs of this scandal to make it sound like that's a hyperbole or an exaggeration. President Trump has been known to exaggerate from time to time. But in this case, he is spot on. Read through what Mr. Fleury wrote on America Under Attack and then the articles that he's published since then following this scandal. It shows that this Obamagate scandal, the stakes were much greater than a presidential resignation. The stakes were actually whether America was going to continue as a constitutional republic or not. And the reason President Trump's talking about this right now is there's been some newly released documents showing that President Obama, when he was the outgoing president, after Trump was elected president, but before he took the oath of office, was actually spying on the phone calls. Why? Not just collecting the metadata, but actually listening to the conversations of Trump's then National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. They realized that because Mr. Fleury's talked in his article Saving America from the Radical Temporarily about a meeting that took place on January 5th, 2017 between President Obama and his top security advisors. And during that meeting, these spies, they set all sorts of espionage traps. They set an espionage trap for Trump. They set an espionage trap for Flynn. Probably set an espionage trap for a few other people. But the one we're focusing on right now is the one they set for Michael Flynn, because he was the incoming national security advisor for the Trump administration. And before Trump took the oath of office, he had some conversations with the Russian ambassador, which isn't illegal. That's why Russia sends an ambassador here, is to have conversations with people about what the sanction policy, economic sanctions against Russia would likely be under the Trump administration. Well, in that January 5th meeting, as it's now been revealed, the deputy attorney general, Sally Yates, at the time said that she told the FBI that Obama was talking about the details of these conversations that Flynn was having with the Russian ambassador. And even she was shocked, because she's like, the outgoing president knows what the national security advisor of the incoming president said in a private phone call with the Russian ambassador. Therefore, he's tapping the phones. She also mentioned that they mentioned the Logan Act. It's a really old, like 1799 American law that's probably unconstitutional and has never been used before, that says that private citizens can't discuss foreign policy with foreign governments. Even if it did apply, I don't think it would apply to an incoming presidential administration. It's meant for people like me who have no business talking to the Russians about sanctions policy. But it's interesting because Yates had mentioned that Obama, he'd been wiretapping the phones, and he mentioned the Logan Act. And then they leaked that information to the press. And so the press was saying, like, oh, Flynn violated the Logan Act. He's going to get in big trouble. And so then they sent a couple FBI agents to talk to him, and he didn't want to get in big trouble. So I don't know exactly what he told the FBI agents, but apparently he didn't tell them the complete and unvarnished truth. And then Mike Pence asked him about it, and he lied to Mike Pence as well, which is why Trump fired him. But the interesting thing with this January 5th meeting is the whole thing was a setup. They wiretapped the phones, leaked it to the media, sent these FBI agents to talk to him. Because Flynn had read the media report, he knew he was going to get in trouble, or he thought he was going to get in trouble. He actually probably wouldn't have if he just told the truth, because it wasn't illegal for him to do what he did. But then he got caught lying to the FBI, and then, yeah, he was worried about, lied to Mike Pence after that, tried to save his reputation, and ended up getting kicked out of the Trump administration, which they call that a perjury trap, because then once you're caught in a lie, you can publish the media that, like, Flynn lied, and then you're like, oh, well, if he's a liar, maybe we can't believe anything he says, and all the other allegations against him illegally colluding with the Russians, they must be true as well. This is not logically consistent. Just because you're guilty of one thing doesn't mean you're necessarily guilty of everything.
Well, not only were they trying to cast doubt on his credibility and the credibility of the Trump administration, but they were actually, like Stephen Fleury has been covering on the Trumpet Daily radio show this week, eliminating Michael Flynn to prevent him from uncovering the fact that they had been spying more generally and broadly on Trump officials.
Right, because actually now we're talking more about the spying about Flynn, because that's more a more recent revelation. But even back in that article we mentioned earlier, the Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily talks a lot about the spying on Carter Page, which was another setup, because the CIA director at the time, John Brennan, is widely believed to at least be the one who told the FBI that Carter Page had been talking to the Russians, but didn't tell the FBI that he was talking to the Russians as a contractor for the CIA. And so it's kind of like, it's almost, this is a little bit of hyperbole, but it's almost like Brennan saying, is like, oh yeah, I think Flynn's talking to the Russians. I cut him a check to do it for me, but it's a...
Right.
We'll leave that part out. We'll just say he's talking about the Russians, and then leak that to the media. And then you're like, oh, it's a little bit different whether you're doing it on your own or you're doing it for the U.S. government.
So, yeah, you've written an article about this, and you point right back to something that Gerald Fleury wrote in that Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily article. These officials led by Obama were trying to figure out how to continue an investigation on the next sitting president who would be their own boss, and it was based on a deceitful premise, what was essentially political propaganda. We're seeing this more and more clearly, just how far they were willing to go in order to undermine the Trump presidency and to protect themselves. This is just becoming clearer and clearer with these recent documents that have been released. And I wanted to talk about just a bit about the reactions from the left. These Obama officials and even the mainstream media are totally unapologetic about this. They have no sense of that they're chastened by the fact that all of this has been exposed in the public.
Right, because even the former President Obama, or at least his press office, released a statement saying that, like, if Flynn is not convicted for perjury. It'll be a great crime against the rule of law.
Right.
And this is the guy who was in the meeting that designed the trap to get him in trouble for, I guess, perjury, as he puts it.
Yeah.
But it's, and so you'd think there'd be anyone with a shred of a conscience would feel a little guilty
right.
that this guy is potentially going to jail for a trap that you premeditatedly set out for him.
Yeah.
But no, they just keep double down with their narrative that Trump's an illegitimate president. He colluded with the Russians. Mike Flynn's a liar and a perjurer. And it does get to, it reminds you of another article Mr. Fleury wrote, A New Age of Will Worship is Here.
Mm-hmm.
We can put that in the show notes. It just talks about, it's actually going through some of the psychology of Adolf Hitler that says that, like, if you just lie and lie and lie and lie and lie and lie and lie again and again and again with no apology whatsoever, a lot of the normal people in the nation won't be able to comprehend that someone could be so evil and start to think that he's actually telling the truth.
Right.
And if you get enough people that really believes that America's the rule of law in America is being destroyed by a Russian plant
right.
in the office, I mean, that could get really messy. There's lots of Bible prophecies about Isaiah 1:7, Isaiah 3:1-12, about like violence and rioting in America. That does sound kind of like the type of thing that would that would happen if a large segment of the population rebelled against the government.
Yeah, this is a huge, very important point that you make in this article. Here we have these revelations of genuine corruption, and yet astoundingly, the view that these Obama officials and the mainstream media are pushing that it's corruption on the part of Trump. So, you know, he's dropping these charges against Michael Flynn, and they're saying that this is the destruction of the rule of law. It's quite a remarkable magic trick they're pulling. But you get enough Americans convinced against all the evidence that it's the incumbent president, it's the currently sitting president where the corruption is. A lot of people lose confidence in the system. You could easily see that turning into a very violent spirit of protest, things turning very ugly very quickly.
Right, yeah. I mean, a lot of the Bible prophecies that talk about that violence, I mean, the main emphasis is on violence combined with a trade siege. But yeah, you could definitely see, just looking at tensions now, that if a trade siege affected food supplies at all, it wouldn't take much of a trigger to get things pretty tense and people at each other's throats.
Yeah. Well, watch for this article by Andrew Miller that's going up on the website shortly. Trump, Obamagate, the biggest political crime in American history. And we'll also link to those landmark articles from Gerald Fleury, where he has been talking about this, as well as America Under Attack, the booklet that really started the discussion and exposed this spiritual dimension of what's happening within America. Thank you very much for that, Andrew. Over now to Europe. France is flexing its authoritarian muscles. This week it passed an internet hate speech law of breathtaking scope. Even some European lawmakers say France has gone too far in limiting free speech. For this story, we'll go to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, France's new law now requires search engines and social media sites to take down links to any website that has illegal content, so anything that violates French law, they've got to take that down within 24 hours. Anything that's, I think it's manifestly illegal is the test there. If they fail to do so, they could get fines of up to about $1.3 million. So there's a pretty massive incentive here for companies to be very quick to take things down. And France isn't the only country that's gone down this route. Germany had introduced a similar law a couple of years ago. What happened in Germany was because hate speech is illegal in France, quote unquote, and in Germany. Germany passed their law. Within 24 hours, the justice minister himself had some of his posts deleted by Twitter. This term hate speech is so broad. And then when you have the threat of massive fines, it makes these tech companies, you know, very keen to delete things.
Yeah.
And basically, you know, that term hate speech, so many things can be twisted to be called hate speech.
Well,
so
yeah, can you give us some examples of what they would consider hate speech, and then who decides?
Well, I don't know the specifics of the definitions in France. I guess part of the problem is it can vary so much from country to country.
Yeah.
In general, anything that is critical of race would be hate speech. Religion in a lot of countries would be criticized, would be hate speech. At the European Court of Justice, for example, recently ruled that it was illegal to say Muhammad is a pedophile. That counts as hate speech, despite that pretty much being an objectively true statement. Marrying an 8-year-old, I think it was. So legitimate criticism of other religions, criticism generally of Islam, has often been counted as hate speech. Holocaust denial is illegal as well. And then in places like Poland, that's been twisted to basically anything talking about Polish complicity in the Holocaust has been kind of made illegal. So you can see this can be stretched in a number of different directions depending on which government is doing the definitions. And a lot of it just comes down to the judges. There was a ruling from that Court of Justice a few months back, where they basically said that European judges can order any content taken down anywhere in the world, and that there was no higher authority. And they said, well, just use this power responsibly, because you're the ones ultimately making the decision. So a lot of it gets back to courts and judges, and in some cases even just bureaucrats.
So over €1 million penalty. This is a massive penalty. And as you intimated, these companies, they're already showing themselves quite willing to pull things down quickly, pull the trigger on anything that they don't really like. But this incentivizes them to do that all the more. You know, in thinking about this, in some ways you're seeing the headlines make it sound like this is Europe versus big tech, but in a lot of ways their interests align. They both want to make the progressive perspective the only perspective. As you said, the way they're defining hate speech, they can pretty well define that however they want to.
Right. I mean, YouTube CEO even was just on a podcast this last week saying, we've been downplaying non-mainstream sources. We've been promoting mainstream sources. We're actually losing money on this. People aren't clicking on the mainstream sources. They don't want them, no matter how hard we keep pushing them and pushing them up on our homepage and the search results. But we don't care. We're going to keep doing this anyway. So absolutely, they're still keen to do a lot of these things. But what I think is important to remember, especially if, you know, if you're listening to this in America and you think, well, that's crazy what they're doing in France. No, this isn't just about France. This is about you still. The rules for just about the global internet are increasingly being written in Europe. And sure, they're pushing these tech companies in a direction they want to go anyway. But at the same time, the parameters for all of that censorship, exactly where those lines are drawn, what is censored, what isn't, Europe is the one that's deciding a lot of that. And ultimately, Germany is the one that's behind a lot of this. There was a great article in Project Syndicate just last month, how Europe rules the digital economy. And that was just going through how you've got this massive market in Europe of people that go online. And what happens more and more is, rather than, say, Facebook having a more restrictive policy for Europe and a less restrictive policy for the United States and everywhere else, they just apply one policy that matches the most restrictive standards. And then that's good. They don't get penalized by Europe. They don't get penalized by America. So when you see France introducing hate speech legislation, and Germany has already done this for the internet, and the European Union is currently working on a bill that would do this for the whole of the European Union, this isn't just France setting the rules for France. This is a new global standard that's being written right now within Europe.
This really takes us back to another landmark article by our editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury. Just a couple of years ago, he wrote that article about Germany taking control of the internet. This was our July 2019. This was just last summer, the cover story of our Trumpet edition. And he's warning about this very thing, exactly what you're describing here.
Exactly. It's he was talking about how far that process had already gone, where just about globally, again, European laws on copyright legislation, on protecting personal data, some of those have been applied worldwide. And what he was saying in that article was, well, look, this isn't just about protecting individuals' personal data. That, you know, that sounds fairly innocuous. No, this is about Germany writing the rules for the internet, and ultimately a German-led Europe getting control of what you can and can't say anywhere in the world. And, you know, he pointed to what was happening here as something that really does expose Europe. You know, it exposes the European project for what it is. It's an attempt at domination.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something that wants control. It's not something that's just about nations getting together and trading together and sitting down and singing Kumbaya so that they can all hold hands and be friends. You know, this is a power that's described in the Bible that is rising up again, a power that wants to dominate, that wants to conquer. And you see them, you see that being played out now in a new domain when it comes to the internet.
You mentioned the prophecies of this upcoming power, and I think there are chapters in the book of Revelation that describe just how far-reaching its power is, particularly economically. Maybe you could just describe the context, why we're looking at this this type of development and really seeing something to be concerned about.
Yeah, so the Bible talks about this, a new world power that's coming on the scene, a power that has risen up in Europe repeatedly, and a power that's rising up again. And Revelation 17 is one of the key chapters that talks about this power. It talks about it in terms of being a beast that's led by a woman, and a beast in biblical symbolism. You can look back in the book of Daniel, you know, that's talking about empires. A woman is a type of a church, so it's a church-state type union rising up. You turn right over to the next chapter, Revelation 18, and it talks about the whole global economy being dominated by this power. All of its merchants are wealthy. In fact, merchants from other countries are being made wealthy by trading with it. They're the center of the global economy. The New York and London is located within this power. And then you look at some of these other scriptures, and it describes this church that having, or this empire setting rules to please the church. That governs it, and determining, well, what days you can work on, what days you can't work on, certain people being excluded from global trade. Freedom of conscience isn't a thing for this empire. It's a church-state union, and it's something that enforces conformity to a certain extent, conformity with the beliefs of this state religion. So something dominating the economy, dominating what people are allowed to say. And when you see what Europe is doing with it's getting control of the internet, you see that power rising, and you see that pretty bleak picture. I think, you know, I think we've all come across videos that YouTube has taken down and things like that just over the last few weeks with coronavirus. And that's not all Europe forcing them to do that, but we are starting to feel the effects of some of this censorship that Europe is pushing. And, you know, the Bible talks about this getting much, much worse. It's leading to a very dark time, and it's part of a wonderful plan that God has to correct the world and get them obeying him. But and then all the blessings that come along with that. But we're seeing just a tiny, tiny foretaste of what's coming from this power, even just in the last few weeks.
Well, we'll link to that article, Germany is taking control of the internet, we really appreciate you bringing that to us, Richard. He definitely gave the overview of these restrictions of freedom that we're going to see in the time ahead. You know, it's remarkable looking at how much this is already happening within America. I'd like to go back to Andrew for a related story to see just how much power these tech companies already have in this nation. Richard mentioned the self-censorship that's taking place on YouTube and so on. But they have a lot of political power. Andrew, tell us about that.
Right, yeah. The Wall Street Journal just published an article this month titled Big Tax, Big Spenders that was highlighting that Silicon Valley companies like Amazon.com have spent $4.5 million on lobbying politicians in the first quarter of this year alone. And last year, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, they spent almost $40 million. All said and told, I mean, this year's not over yet, but it's usually to the tune of like $50 million a year that these big tech companies spent lobbying politicians, which is discussing lobbying funds is never the most gripping story, or so it seems at first, but it is significant. Is that oftentimes when you'll see, like Richard was mentioning, YouTube or someplace like that taking down videos, you'll have the response like, "Oh, they're a private company; they can do what they want. If they want to censor videos, let them censor videos." But these this lobbying money is designed to get them political favors that helps them establish near monopolies. In which case they can censor what they want because they're allegedly private, but it amounts to making it hard for people to access certain ideas. And that is a big danger. One thing we can put in the show notes is a Kia David program from Mr. Fleury titled Daniel 8:12, A Dual Prophecy. And Daniel 8:12 is a prophecy about an Antiochus figure and his supporters, an army of demons and evil men, casting truth to the ground. And obviously that's something you're seeing all over the world right now in all nations, is like truth being cast to the ground. And like I said, the thrust of it is the devil and his demons and the Antiochus figures he works through. But we've covered a lot on this program about the deep state and how the devil's used the deep state to cast truth to the ground. And some of these deep state tentacles, whether they're a spiritual connection or a concrete monetary connection, do extend even out into CNN, Google, the media, academia. I have an article, an older article entitled Barack Obama's Media Empire Strikes Back, which puts a little bit of a spotlight on all the Obama administration officials who now work for Google and CNN and MSNBC and things like that, continuing to do that same sort of thing they did in office and even now that they're out of office.
Thank you very much for that, Andrew. New information has emerged about a massive hack of Germany's parliament back in 2015. It came from a nation that Germany has been doing quite a lot of business with. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, so this it was an attack that completely shut down Germany's federal parliament, the Bundestag. It shut down its IT infrastructure back in May 2015, as you said, for several days. And it caused the entire parliament to go offline. And the attackers were able to access confidential emails from German government officials, including even those of Chancellor Angela Merkel. So it was really no small attack. And it's been under investigation for a number of years. And now Germany has announced that the culprit was Russia. A Russian agent named Dmitry Baden, who works for the Russian Military Secret Service, the GRU, was, they say, the primary architect of this breach. And under him, the Russian hacker collective known as Fancy Bear carried the whole thing out. So Fancy Bear has really become quite famous over the last decade or so for having just some of the most talented cyber espionage agents on the planet. They've routinely hacked the government and military and security organizations of a number of countries, especially NATO-aligned countries. Some of their big successes have included attacking the campaign of Emmanuel Macron when he was running for the French presidency, and then also the Democratic National Committee here in the U.S., and also the White House with a spear phishing attack. And now we can add Germany's Bundestag to the list of Fancy Bear's conquests. And with this hack, Fancy Bear was apparently able to acquire about 16 gigabytes of data, and they were able to disrupt computer systems from Germany's Left Party and members of parliament, and as I mentioned, even Angela Merkel's office there. So we don't know exactly what was obtained in this, but it would be some very high-level information, and the breach was mainly intended to destabilize the political system during Germany's 2017 federal election, which it did have some success in doing.
How has Germany responded to these revelations?
Yeah, well, Angela Merkel did chime in on this. She seemed like she almost wished that the investigation would have found that it was anyone besides Russia that was behind it. She spoke about it. She said, "I may very honestly say it pains me. On the one hand, I make an effort on a daily basis to have a better relationship with Russia. But on the other hand, there's hard evidence that Russian powers are behaving in this way. And of course, it's an area of tension." And then a little later, she said, "I find it outrageous. Of course, it damages any sort of trusting collaboration between Germany and Russia." So she really sounds, I think, personally wounded by this. And she's saying that her ability to trust Russia has just taken a major blow here. And I think that's representative of a lot of the sentiments that we're hearing out of Germany in response to this. But we also know that these kinds of attacks are somewhat common, maybe not on the scale of this one that just happened here, but it is something that leaders in the modern world are coming to accept more and more as somewhat inevitable.
Yeah, Richard, you had a comment.
Yeah, there is a bit of a pots and kettles aspect to this. I think it's hard for Germany to get annoyed with anybody for hacking, given the levels of revelation event about them over the last few years, where they've hacked the U.S., worked with the U.S. to hack other people, spied on the European Union, spied on NATO, spied on the BBC and the New York Times. So there's they're as much sinned against, or as much sinned as sinned against, if not more on the sinning side, I think here.
Although I suppose hacking in a way that completely shuts the Bundestag down for several days and capturing the scale of information that they were actually able to steal, but this relationship is historically very fraught between Germany and Russia. They sometimes behave like friends, but that really isn't the reality.
That's right, and that's something that Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury has written quite a lot about over the years, just about this relationship between Russia and Germany. These are both, you know, just major world powers. They're both also major players in end-time Bible prophecy. And the prophecies do show that in the near future, these two will work together for a short time against the United States mainly. That's the mostly in the Mart of Nations prophecy that we find in the books of Isaiah and Ezekiel. But then after that, the timeline of end-time events shows that Germany and the rest of Europe will be troubled by what they see Russia along with China doing. That's recorded in Daniel 11, mostly in verse 44 there. And it'll actually lead to a great clash between these two. Mr. Fleury writes about this in his book, Daniel Unlocks Revelation. He writes, "There's some real tension between Russia and Germany. That tension will continue to build until Daniel 11:44 is fulfilled, when tidings from the northeast will trouble the EU, or the King of the North. Then, seeing Russia and China getting ready to attack, it will strike first." Mm-hmm. So, you know, in the short term, we should expect to see Russia and Germany working past these kinds of things, these kinds of tensions, and actually entering more and more deeply into a partnership. But eventually they will have a mighty clash. And I think the news this week about Germany discovering Russia disrupting its parliament like that gives us some insight into the kinds of tensions that will eventually culminate in that clash.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Jeremiah. A story now about another hack, this just last month in the Jewish state of Israel by a state the Israelis know is a clear enemy. They don't pretend to be friends with. For this, we will turn to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, this took place towards the 22nd and 23rd of April, and it was only really released to the public and discussed about a week after that. and it regards an attack on the water infrastructure inside Israel, sewage treatment, and also different pumping stations and wastewater treatment plants. And this, while nothing seems to be too affected by it, the Israeli security cabinet actually met for the first time in months to discuss this issue. And before they went in, all the people in the security cabinet had to sign forms that they weren't going to leak anything to the public. So we don't know a lot of the details about it, but we do know that it was by Iran. They came out of the meeting. Well, from the meeting, they said this was an attack that goes against all codes of war. Even from the Iranians, we didn't expect something like this. And so this was an attack that likely impacted the civilian infrastructure of water getting to citizens, whether it was water that would be contaminated, that would then go into Israeli households. It wasn't just, it seems, the shutting down of the water. There was emails sent around by and directives sent around by the cybersecurity forces inside Israel, as well as the water treatment forces, security agency, that basically said that everyone that's associated with this, change your passwords, reboot your systems. If you cannot access your passwords, shut down, turn off the systems, because Israel was worried that there was a pretty serious security breach at the hands of the Iranians. And one that, if it does defy the codes of war, then we're talking something in terms of a chemical attack of something like that that could have reached into Israel's water system.
Mm-hmm. So we don't know exactly the nature of the attack. It's just Israeli officials that are saying this violated codes of war. And essentially the point being, another example of Iran really belligerently going after Israel and showing just how aggressive it is.
Yeah, I think it is. And I think it actually does speak to the abilities that the Iranians do have. We tend to think of Iranians maybe not being as sophisticated, but they are. And they had an attack against Bahrain's water facilities, a cyber attack back in 2019. And this really, I think, hit Israel in a very vulnerable position. I've toured through these massive water facilities, be it the water treatment facilities or the massive desalination plants that they have. They have 5 desalination plants right now that Israel uses for 60 to 80% of its water at any given time. One of these plants, the Sorek facility just south of Tel Aviv, produces 20% of Israel's daily water needs. It comes from a desalination plant. Mm-hmm. And this is critical infrastructure that if somebody was able to sabotage that could really hurt Israel, given that it doesn't have massive reservoirs of water. Mm-hmm. And as I was touring those facilities, this question came up a couple of times, asking the people that ran it that were basically saying, look how great this is. Indeed it was. What would happen, you know, if a terrorist attack could take place here, or are you worried about this? And they'd refuse to comment about that type of thing. Mm-hmm. And here we see it happening in terms of the wastewater that Israel, you know, reboots into their system. It's incredible. 87% of any bit of water that goes down a drain in Israel is reused. The next country closest to that is Spain, that uses about 17% of its wastewater. So Israel is at the cutting edge of water treatment, water desalination. They can, I think it's like 55 cents per cubic meter. They can produce water from the Mediterranean, turn into drinkable water. The next country is at like $3. So they can do it so much cheaper than everybody else as well. And it got to the point, it is to the point now where Israel pumps its water out of the Mediterranean Sea. And they have the technology to convert it to rainwater or water, drinkable water. And so what happens if you do have foreign actors being able to infiltrate that system? Mm-hmm. That affects Israel rapidly. I think it takes about 6 hours or something like that, if my memory serves me correctly, from water to go through the plant, to get into the system, to go, actually come from the ocean, go through the processes from the plant into the pipes that goes into the taps in people's houses. And so this is a serious breach, and it should worry Israel that Iran was able to do this.
Yeah. Well, we do have an article that will appear next week on thetrumpet.com on this subject. You can watch for that. Thank you very much, Brent. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, some news about Germany's military presence in North Africa, a shocking poll coming out of Israel, and more truth about the early stages of this coronavirus pandemic from China. We'll be right back.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
Germany is boosting its military presence in North Africa. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yes, Germany's parliament is currently debating the mandate that Germany has for placing troops in North Africa, and they want to make a couple of significant changes. They want to up the total number of troops that are allowed in the area by about 100. So there's around 1,000 that they have the limit for. There's about 450 that are deployed under a European Union training mission into Mali. And then there's another fairly large contingent of troops serving under the UN. And at the same time, they want to increase the area that these troops are allowed by the German parliament to go into. So currently they're mostly in Mali, but they want to be able to spread out now throughout more of North Africa, Burkina Faso, Chad, Mauritania and Niger. And then they want also to get these troops closer to the front line. So at the moment, their mandate is strictly training Malian troops. And then when the Malian troops go into battle, you know, that's it, they're off. Now they want it so at least that the European troops, the German troops, are accompanying the Malian troops closer to the front lines and interacting to them much closer with the violence. But what's going on here really is, we've not heard about it much, mainly because Corona's been dominating the headline, but terrorist attacks in North Africa are increasing quite dramatically. March 23rd, for example, was Chad's deadliest ever terrorist attack when Boko Haram killed 92 people. In March 24th in Niger, 47 killed by also a Boko Haram. There were 4,000 deaths in attacks in 2019 compared to just 770 in 2018. So you're seeing a big uptick in Islamist violence in North Africa. You're seeing at least talk from America about America pulling out of the region. And then you're seeing a steady step-by-step increase in European presence in the region. And I think this is, there's an article from Trumpet Editor-in-Chief Gerald Fleury called Watch Algeria, where he just has some really specific forecasts there that I think you can see how already being proven true. He talks about a coming clash between European powers in North Africa. He said, watch for terrorism to get worse. Watch for terrorism backed by Iran to get worse. Watch for Europe to step up to confront that. And he said that this whole region is building into a battleground with huge implications. And you see that now already. We also have an article on our website just talking about how the low oil prices could destabilize this even further. So there's some forecasts that I think you can say, well, you're seeing those play out already, and they're based on Bible prophecy. They're based on prophecies in Daniel 11 of Europe and radical Islam clashing and have this, you know, this massive world-shaking clash. But if you look at North Africa right now, you can see that clash building already.
Thank you for that, Richard. We will link to that article from Gerald Fleury, Watch Algeria, as well as Oil Price Crash Destabilizes Africa and Middle East. We also have an article about this specific troop deployment, Germany Bolsters Sahel Troops, that you can find on the front page of thetrumpet.com. Moving on, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is infamous, obviously one of the most contentious in the world, yet there's always been an interesting paradox. Most Palestinians living in East Jerusalem actually say they prefer living under an Israeli government. They don't want to live in a Palestinian state. New surveys, though, show that these attitudes are shifting dramatically. For this, we'll go back to Brent Nachtigall.
Yeah, this poll was conducted by a man that's been conducting these type of things for about 20 years inside East Jerusalem and the West Bank, really trying to get a feel for Palestinian perception and Palestinian belief in terms of their relationship with Israel and a whole host of issues. And it turns out that back in 2015, there was about 55% or 52% people that would rather say that they would be under Israeli control in East Jerusalem, even if they were Palestinians. Palestinians in East Jerusalem, we're going to be under Israeli control. We would like that. We don't want to be in a Palestinian state run by Hamas or the Palestinian Authority. That's not going to be good for us. And what he's discovered is a steady decrease of that type of thought to now we have the opposite taking place, where we have about that same number saying that most of them actually prefer to be Palestinian citizens in a future Palestinian state. Now, this is really important because East Jerusalem, it has about 300 plus thousand Palestinians. And right now, what it used to be is a lot of those would be more pro-Israel. And so Israel felt pretty protected about the fact that you had Palestinians there, but they liked Israeli rule. Now you have during a time period in which the Trump administration is discussing really having a lot of those East Jerusalem Palestinians being part of the state of Israel, mm-hmm. a lot of them actually don't want to be like that anymore. They would rather be in part of a future Palestinian state. And what's also interesting about, there was another couple of questions that were added to this survey, and it indicated that it wasn't just we want to be in a Palestinian state. There's a hardening position against Israel. Two-thirds of people that were interviewed said that even if there is a compromise reached with Israel, that a compromise is always temporary, that they believe, two-thirds of East Jerusalemites believe that they want all the territory from the river to the sea. That was the terminology inside the survey, which means eventually they want to be controlling not just East Jerusalem, but they do have a desire to push Israel out completely. Now, a lot of them believe that's not going to happen, mm-hmm. but it is stunningly different from what we saw, say, 5 years ago, the way that they saw Israel as perhaps a two-state solution could work, and that would be the end of it. What they're seeing now is a two-state solution is just a means partway towards a greater goal.
You see this as a response to the resurgence in the peace process here, that this we actually see kind of a hardening of both sides and where this is actually going to reach a crisis point?
Well, it seems to have already been changing before the talk of President Trump coming in, but it really has increased linearly. Let's say from 2015 to now, each year, more and more Palestinians rathering to be part of a Palestinian state than in Israel. I do think the timing is extremely significant, though, because mm-hmm. in a couple of months, Israel is going to be eligible to annex parts of the West Bank and parts of East Jerusalem under Israeli sovereignty. And that includes about 180,000 of these very same Palestinians that do not want to live under Israeli rule. Yep. Now, as part of the peace deal, Trump has said, and that would be negotiated, is that Palestinians that are inside of Israel, they can still be part of the future Palestinian state, even though they're in East Jerusalem and they're inside the Israeli part of the city. You can be Palestinian citizens, which seems to me like a very dangerous situation, where you're going to have a border, you're going to have the wall that's already there, really, and the Palestinians on the Israeli side of that are still in allegiance to the Palestinian Authority rather than Israel. And there's a lot of them. There's 180,000 of them that would be in that situation. And this is really foretelling some problems with the Trump peace plan, that going forward, you're going to have a thorn in Israel's side in terms of these Palestinians that don't want to live under Israeli rule. But also looking at biblical prophecy, we know that one of the critical things that we're watching for is for half of Jerusalem to be taken over by Palestinians from Israelis. And so this would be including the parts of Jerusalem that Israel is going to get in this peace deal mm-hmm. really shortly. That is not going to be under full Israeli control. Biblical prophecy says that. And if you have a lot of Palestinians, almost 200,000 of them, that are inside East Jerusalem, yet under Israeli rule, that don't want to be there, you can really see that those could be motivated to try and make this push, eventually a violent push, as we see it in the book of Zechariah, for a full control over the half of that city.
Oh, very interesting. That prophecy explained fully in Gerald Fleury's booklet, Jerusalem in Prophecy. You can find that in our literature library, and we'll link to it in the show notes for today's program. Thank you for bringing that to us, Brent. One final story on the program today. COVID-19 came from China, and investigation into the way the Chinese government handled the outbreak from the beginning has exposed some extremely troubling truth about the nature of that nation's communist regime. For this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, there was a report released this week by the CIA here in the U.S., and it apparently confirms what I think is one of the most disturbing accusations about the behavior of the Chinese Communist Party during the coronavirus outbreak. And that is that back in mid-January, China recognized how dangerous the coronavirus was and saw that it was transmissible from person to person. But rather than trying to help the world see early and take measures to contain it early, the Chinese leadership did exactly the opposite. They actually tried to prevent the World Health Organization, the WHO, from telling the world about it. So this was when some WHO agents were in Wuhan, China, investigating the outbreak, which, you know, at that time was pretty much confined to just that part of China. And the CCP told the WHO that they would kick them out and not allow them to keep on investigating if the organization told the world about the possibility of human-to-human transmission and if it declared a global health emergency. So, you know, we had already learned about the way China silenced local doctors who were trying to sound the alarm about this disease. We'd already learned about the way China had muzzled journalists and really anyone posting about it online in those early days. But these new revelations show that the CCP also coerced the WHO into delaying the kind of declaration and just, you know, announcement of information that could have really minimized the global impact of this virus.
So they bought themselves some time. What did they do with the time that they bought?
Yeah, I think that's probably the most vile part of this whole story. And that is that while the CCP was strong-arming the WHO into keeping quiet, it was also issuing orders for Chinese embassies and other Chinese organizations in countries around the world to buy up as much medical equipment in those countries as they could. From January 24th to February 29th, China imported 2.5 billion pieces of epidemic personal protective equipment, or PPE, from nations around the world. That's just a staggering amount of gear that China bought up while other nations were unaware of how disruptive the coronavirus would end up being in their own countries. So, you know, some of that was just China trying to equip itself to be able to handle the disease in China. But of course, China knew that by silencing the WHO, the disease was sure to spread and that the countries where it had just bought up all those supplies would then be desperate for them a short time later. And so with those shortages everywhere, China was then well positioned to sell much of this equipment back to many of those countries at a huge markup. So, you know, I don't know how much of this was planned out from the beginning by China for it to go that way, but that's how it ended up happening. And it made this situation far more chaotic and far more expensive for nations around the world than it otherwise would have been.
For so long now, from so many quarters, we've been hearing nothing but praise for the way that China has handled this epidemic. It's hard to understand why there would be so many sources less interested in the revelations that you're describing here. But I think we have our cover story of the next Trumpet edition, an article by Brad McDonald about the WHO and China and how so many international actors are there. There is a spiritual force unifying so much of what they're doing. Why they would cover for China in a case like this, why they would continue to praise China despite these revelations, I think really can be explained in that from that same source. Anything that you would point someone to for more information about what's going on there in China?
I think Mr. McDonald's article would be an excellent one to put this in some spiritual context, really. And then also, Mr. Gerald Fleury had a really powerful article in our February 2020 issue. It's called The Climax of Man's Rule Over Man. And it really talks about the way we can expect China and Russia and, you know, the European nations led by Germany to become sort of the global dominant powers. And just this sort of behavior that we've seen from the CCP, that's going to be going global. And it's what we've seen this week is just a small preview of the kind of governance and chaos that will soon really dominate the world.
Pretty chilling. Thank you for that, Jeremiah. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. You can email us your thoughts to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal. Thanks to Jeremiah for engineering and production. And I'll leave you with the words of William Ellery Channing. Difficulties are meant to rouse, not discourage. The human spirit is to grow strong by conflict. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.